KTRS. I am Paul Harris. You can follow me online on my website, harrisonline.com, or on Facebook, where I take all friends. Every friend request gets accepted. And you can also follow me on Twitter, at Paul Harris Show. My guest today is an author by the name of Joshua Zeitz, who has written a very interesting book called Building the Great Society, Inside Lyndon Johnson's White House. And you might think, well, why are we talking about Lyndon Johnson here in 2018? Well, we've seen a lot of Lyndon Johnson movies in the last few years. Woody Harrelson had horrible makeup in Rob Reiner's movie LBJ a couple of years ago. Bryan Cranston won all sorts of awards for his stage show and then his HBO show All the Way, in which he played the 36th president. John Carroll Lynch played LBJ in a movie called Jackie, in which Natalie Portman played Jackie Kennedy. Liev Schreiber played LBJ in The Butler. Tom Wilkinson in Selma. Those are all in, I think, just the last 5 years or so. And there's been a whole resurgence of interest in Lyndon Baines Johnson, particularly in comparison to the political situation we find ourselves in now. So it's an interesting time to be talking about this president, and a good time to bring in an author who's written a beautiful book about him. Joshua Zeitz, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
You say in the book that the legacy that is most at risk under our current president is not that of the previous president, Barack Obama, but of LBJ. Why?
Well, if you look at the slate of programs that fall under the sort of the heading of the header of the Great Society, when it's Medicare and Medicaid, federal aid to public education, federal aid to colleges, civil rights and voting rights, nutritional assistance for children and families that are struggling. All of these programs are currently under assault. The Republican Party has, for many years at least, been rhetorically dedicated to the proposition that the Great Society should be dismantled. This is the first time in decades that they've enjoyed the presidency, both houses of Congress, and not just both houses of Congress, but a Republican leadership that is deeply ideologically committed to not only dismantling the components of the Great Society that were dedicated to alleviating poverty for those who lived in it, but also to dismantling key components of civil rights legislation that was otherwise for years considered unassailable.
Yeah. How does that compare to the Congress that LBJ had to deal with?
It's a much different situation, you know, partly because in LBJ's days, the Republicans and Democrats were not as ideologically polarized. You had conservative Democrats, most of them from the South, and you also had a decent minority of the House and Senate Republican caucuses comprised of liberal or moderate Republicans, mostly from the North and Midwest. But Johnson was able to enact such an enormous slate of programs, in part because after 1964, he enjoyed supermajorities in the House and Senate, a courtesy of his landslide victory over Barry Goldwater in 1964. So that having been said, if you look at some of the criticisms of Congress in 1963 on the eve of Kennedy's death, it's almost like you're reading from today's newspapers. I mean, on the eve of Kennedy's death, social welfare legislation, health care legislation, education bills, civil rights legislation, it was all stalled in Congress. They had failed to pass ordinary course of business appropriations bills, and they were governing by continuing resolution, which is normal today, but back then was sort of stunning. So it took Kennedy's death and Johnson's leadership to really create a political moment when things could get done.
And the death of JFK in November of 1963 kind of gave LBJ, as he took over as president, some political capital, because the mood of the country was one of bereavement for several months. I mean, up until the Beatles came in February, but even into the election year of 1964, he still had am I right that he had the support of a lot of the country?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, most of those movies that you mentioned, that I'd forgotten, there are so many of them. You know, when they portray Johnson, the sort of the magical moments, and it's usually one of two, or when he signs the Civil Rights Act or he signs the Voting Rights Act. You know, he was seen as a master legislator, and that's still how we remember him. But it's important to recall that he was successful at getting these bills through Congress for two fundamental reasons. One, as you point out, he enjoyed a groundswell of goodwill following Kennedy's assassination. Americans were eager to get behind their new president. And then he won this landslide victory that delivered him effectively supermajorities in each House of Congress. Mm-hmm. But what I tried to do in the book was not retell that story, because it's been told a million times over, but rather tell the story about what happened the day after he signed all of these bills into effect, whether it was the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts, or Medicare and Medicaid Act, or the Aid to Education Act, and to look at how this talented group of White House aides he had assembled around him were able to build these programs and make them function and make them sustainable, all in the course of about 4.5 years, while also desegregating a third of the country and while also getting mired in Vietnam. That's really quite an extraordinary story.
Yeah, I want to come back to the personnel and I want to come back to Vietnam, but I've got to ask you, since you mentioned it, LBJ is responsible for the Democratic Party essentially losing the South, isn't he?
He is, and he knew it. I mean, one of the remarkable things about Johnson was that he was the Southern Democrat who had been a real temporizer and as conservative as anybody else from his region on race matters throughout the 30s, 40s, and 50s. But he was committed to desegregation and committed to civil rights in his heart. As a president, you know, he made sure that civil rights was deeply embedded in the Great Society. So it's not just that he enforced the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, which he did. And he famously said to Bill Moyers, who was then his young 29-year-old White House aide, that he said after he signed the Civil Rights Act into law, "I've lost the South for a generation." But he knowingly did it. He understood that he had so much political capital, and he was going to have to spend it and draw it down, and that's what it was for. Early in his presidency, as he was made the decision to commit to, you know, to putting the full weight of his office behind getting the Civil Rights Act passed, one of his aides, you know, said, "Well, why do you want to, you know, this is a hopeless cause, you know, you're gonna lose all this goodwill overnight." And he said, "What the hell is the presidency for?" He understood that you had capital and you spent it. And so you look at like the way in which they implemented Medicare, for instance, and they stood the program up within 11 months. They initially, you know, what they did is they went to hospitals and nursing homes, and I say they, I mean the administration, it was being coordinated from the basement of the West Wing, went to 10,000 plus hospitals throughout the South and said, "You're eligible for Medicare money next year in 66, but only if you desegregate ward by ward, floor by floor, room by room. You have to hire black nurses and doctors. You have to post notices in newspapers letting African-American and white residents of the town know that the hospital is now desegregated." You know, they used federal dollars as a carrot and a stick in order to desegregate schools, hospitals, nursing homes. And they did it knowing that they were likely going to flip the South to the Republican Party for years to come. But LBJ realized that he had a moment, he had capital, and he was willing to spend it.
In pushing through Medicare and Medicaid, did he ever want single-payer health care?
No. In fact, it's interesting. They ultimately did the bill signing in Independence, Missouri, with, you know, Harry Truman's hometown, and they did it with Truman, who was then quite elderly. Truman had been a proponent of single-payer health care, and Johnson's aides actually suggested that he not do the bill signing there because they were afraid that conservative Republicans, the business lobby, and the American Medical Association, which had fought tooth and nail against Medicare, would somehow use the bill signing to portray it as a single-payer kind of government healthcare takeover. In fact, this was an era when increasing numbers of Americans in the 20 years after World War II enjoyed access to employer-based provided health care. And so the act was really intended to provide health care to two groups that had been left behind, those who were unemployed and who didn't have access to health care. And originally Medicaid was for the poorest of the poor, and really single mothers as well who weren't in the workforce. And Medicare was obviously designed for the elderly, people who by definition were probably not working anymore. But, you know, that's one of the points I try to draw out in the book. The Great Society was framed in an era of tremendous economic prosperity, a growing economy, low inflation, when millions of Americans, both working class and middle class, had good jobs that paid more than a living wage, and defined benefits, pensions, and employer-based health care. It didn't anticipate a world in which those things receded, in which the unionized manufacturing jobs were replaced by low-wage service jobs that didn't provide pensions or health care. And so we find ourselves today under strain in a way that I think the framers of the Great Society didn't anticipate. So you ask, did they support it at the time? No. I think, however, having spent a lot of time reading through their papers and their memoirs, their oral histories, I think if you transported them magically to today, they probably would.
Lately, there's also been a lot of talk about Richard Nixon, for what I think are fairly obvious reasons. But when people think about Richard Nixon, they think about two things, Watergate and the Vietnam War. He gets an enormous amount of blame for the Vietnam War. But doesn't that blame really fall better at the feet of Lyndon Baines Johnson? After all, he was president from November of 1963 to January of 1969, and that's when the big buildups were. So why don't we put the blame for Vietnam more on him, and what does that do to his legacy?
Sure. Well, I think he does suffer for it. While it is true that half of the U.S. service deaths in Vietnam occurred under Nixon's watch, it was Johnson who escalated it. It was Johnson who bequeathed that war to Nixon. But I think it has historically damaged his reputation and his legacy. He's seen the historian Robert Dallek wrote a wonderful two-volume biography of Johnson years ago. And the second volume about his presidency is entitled Flawed Giant, and the flaw is in part personal, but largely about Vietnam. And part of, you know, the reason that I think we're going through a reappraisal period right now of Johnson is that for many decades he had been seen as a failed president who accomplished some important things, but ultimately whose reputation was hopelessly damaged by the Vietnam War. And that's not a focus of my book per se, the Vietnam War, but I do have to look at the ways in which his dissemblance on how deeply he had involved the country in the war and on how much it cost and how we were going to pay for it, the dissemblance that came from the White House on that damaged his credibility, it fractured his coalition, led to the end of his presidency. He might well have otherwise run for and won the presidency again in 68, and it put tremendous strain on his ability to grow the Great Society program. So it is an unfortunate but yet really fascinating paradox about him.
You talked before about his political capital after Kennedy's assassination and his landslide victory in 1964. Did the public support for him and for the concept of big government continue throughout his presidency, or did the feelings of the public start turning a little bit?
It turned around 66, 67, and largely because of Vietnam, but also because of a lot of other upheavals that were in some respects related to Vietnam and others not. This was an era of campus unrest, increasingly violent urban riots and uprisings. There was a lot of generational tension that he could not possibly have anticipated. It happened everywhere around the Western world and was related to the sort of maturation of the first, you know, crop of baby boomers. There was inflation that owed in large part to borrowing and wartime spending. So it all came together as a perfect storm. And by 68, he was extraordinarily controversial. But, you know, from 63 to 65, he did enjoy a wellspring of support, and it stretched across, you know, ideology. It stretched across regions. So he had a moment, and he did use it well.
There's also a point in his presidency where he took to the megaphone, the bully pulpit of the presidency, to declare a war on poverty. A three-word phrase that I don't think had been heard in American history before that. It was Johnson who declared that. How'd that work out?
Well, I mean, the war on poverty, which he declared in his first State of the Union address in January of 64, if you look at the component programs, it's everything from Head Start, which remains a vital and very popular program, to you could argue Medicaid was part of it. The idea was that in a growing economy where you could count on, you know, they thought that they had mastered the sort of like levers that would give you boundless economic growth at 5-6% a year with low inflation, that as Walter Lippmann, the octogenarian dean of American journalism, wrote in 1964, whereas in the 1930s, you know, the answer to solving poverty would have been, well, in a sick capitalist, with capitalism being so fundamentally flawed and sick, you have to divide the pie into smaller pieces in order to make sure everybody gets a piece and enough to eat. Today, we can grow the pie at 5 or 6%. And so what we have to do is provide qualitative assistance to people in the form of job training, education, access to health care so they'd be healthy enough to work, access to food if they were living in food insecurity. And if you gave them these qualitative tools, they'd be able to capture their fair share of a forever growing economy. That's what a lot of those measures were intended to do. Now, as I said earlier, we're living in a very different world, and so it's unclear whether these qualitative measures can help people capture opportunity that for many people in many communities doesn't exist anymore. I mean, that having been said, 130 million people today rely on Medicare and Medicaid. If you took it away, that would be devastating. 30 million children today rely on reduced or free school lunches and breakfasts. That's a component of LBJ's war on poverty. If you took that away, it would be a disaster. So by some measures, these programs have reduced the poverty rate by about 26%. So he didn't eliminate poverty. He didn't win the war, but he certainly took made a pretty big dent in it.
Yeah, you make a great argument for it. What do you know now about LBJ that you didn't know when you started researching this book?
I knew he was a complicated character coming in, but I don't think I had a true appreciation for the sort of depth of his intellect. I mean, he could be crass and crude, vulgar, but he was a public policy devotee. He read 300,000 words worth of public policy memoranda that his staff prepared for him and the agencies prepared for him every week, and he was deeply immersed in the minutiae of public policy. When they were desegregating schools after the passage of the Civil Rights Act in 64 and the AIDS Education Act in 65, he would walk in and out of his Joe Califano, domestic policy czar's office, time and again, and ask about desegregation targets in specific school districts, you know, in Alabama or Mississippi. He was really detail oriented. It's a stunning contrast with the current president.
Which of those guys who I mentioned who played LBJ at the beginning of our interview did you think did the best job?
I actually thought Woody Harrelson was masterful.
You did?
Fantastic. Yeah, I think Bryan Cranston was excellent as well. But I was really impressed by Woody Harrelson, and I chose him instead because I think the movie didn't get enough credit. I thought it was really well done.
And even in that makeup?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's makeup. I could look beyond that. I thought, you know, that didn't bother me as much because I really thought that he had captured the sort of the personality and the spirit of it so much that I was sort of convinced. But both that and the All the Way film were spectacular.
The book is called Building the Great Society, Inside Lyndon Johnson's White House. It was published just this week by Viking Press. And here's the guy who wrote it, Joshua Zeitz. Nice work on the book, and thanks for your time today.
Thanks ever so much. It was great talking.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.